calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on rebroadcast on XM Radio on Sundays. This program also streaming live on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.com, and CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. It's Friday. It's the first hour of our three-hour program, and Congressman Bernie Sanders is always with us on Fridays, opens our program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member, neither Democrat nor Republican, an independent member of the House of Representatives in the history of that institution, first elected in, was it 1991, Bernie, you were elected?
Yes, that's right.
First elected in 1991, been reelected seven times. His website, bernie.org. Or house.bernie.gov, but bernie.org. Right now, you're also engaged in a bit of a race for your next election. But let's talk about the issues here.
Okay.
And let me just put out our phone number if you'd like to talk with Bernie. Our number 1-866-440-8466. That's 1-866-440-THOM. And also, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. Bernie, the budget reconciliation bill, this is a big deal.
This is a big deal, Tom, and there's a whole lot of stuff that's going on in D.C. and Capitol Hill right now. Let me just go through some of them. What the Republican leadership is now trying to do in what I consider to be just an outrageous effort is to continue their obsession with more and more tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, and then paying for those tax breaks by cutting programs for the most vulnerable people in our country. Right now, as our health care system continues to disintegrate, as more and more people lack any health insurance, the Republican leadership wants to cut over a period of 5 years $10 billion from Medicaid, which means either people will not have any health insurance or the states will have to pick up that burden. At a time when middle-class families are stressing out trying to afford to send their kids to college, the Republican leadership here wants to cut $14 billion in student aid programs, which will clearly mean that a lot of lower-income, middle-class families are just not going to be able to send their kids to college. And at a time when poverty is increasing and hunger in America is increasing, these guys literally want to cut back on the food stamp program and breakfast and lunch programs in schools for children in America. So what you are really looking at, and this is not rhetoric, it's unfortunately reality, is taking food away from hungry kids in order to give tax breaks to millionaires. And then these people have the nerve to go forward and talk about family values, talk about morality, talk about religion, when what we see here is just an obsession with greed, greed, and more greed. So this is an issue that will probably surface, I think, next week for a vote. Obviously, many of us in Congress are trying to change this legislation and prevent these terrible, terrible cuts. And then as we look at winter coming, and already in states like Vermont, we've already had snowstorms, there is a growing concern that people could very well go cold this winter, because at a time when home heating fuel prices are soaring, the Bush administration and the Republican leadership here are simply, at best, level funding what's called the LIHEAP program, which is the low-income heating assistance program, which helps large numbers of Americans, many seniors, stay warm in the wintertime. So what we want to do is to substantially increase funding for the LIHEAP program to make sure that no senior citizen freezes to death or goes cold this winter or has to take money away from prescription drugs or food in order to heat their home. So that's
they've already voted that down twice now, haven't they?
I think three times in the Senate, but we haven't given up this fight. In fact, we had a majority of the votes in the Senate. Over 50% of senators voted to increase funding. Problem is, you need 60 to overcome a filibuster. Imagine those guys filibustering to make sure that people go cold in the wintertime is somewhat beyond comprehensive, but that's the way it is.
You know, Bernie, I don't think the average American realizes that the Republican majority in the Senate, who gets hysterical about the possibility of the Democrats filibustering a right-wing Supreme Court nominee, is filibustering against the possibility of more aid to families, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, that are going to be hit really hard and the Rocky Mountain states really hit hard with heating bills this winter, low-income families.
That's right. And then at the same time, defending more tax breaks for the wealthy, taking money out of food programs and driving up our national deficit and national debt. I mean, sometimes, you know, I'm involved in politics and I work hard at this 24 hours a day, but sometimes you kind of take a deep breath and you step back and you really do say to yourself, where are these guys coming from? I mean, what motivates somebody to cut food programs, to give tax breaks for the rich?
Well, I have to tell you, Bernie, I have these guys on the radio program. I try to get them on at least once a week, at least a couple of times a week, ideally, to present their worldview so that our listeners are actually hearing the real, where they actually lay it on the line rather than just the spin. And like the folks from the Ayn Rand Institute, the objectivists and some of the more conservative members of Congress, and they just come right out and say, hey, we think that the government has no business taking money away from millionaires and billionaires or anybody who works. I mean, they'll frame it as anybody who works, but in particular millionaires and billionaires, because they're among the most productive members of society, no business taking money away from them to help people who are in need. That's simply their point of view, and they believe that that's a moral position. I think what we have is a different opinion about morality.
Right. I mean, they're back to the survival of the fittest. They're back to a period where everybody is in it for themselves, and you're not supposed to look at what's happening in this world. You're not supposed to appreciate the role that we play from a moral perspective in assisting each other, being part of, you know, a society. They don't believe in society.
Yeah, they're throwing out the Jewish notion of tikkun, or the Christian notion, Matthew 25, of, you know, as you do unto the least among us, you've done unto me.
Right.
They're just tossing that stuff out.
But it's also very easy for these guys to come up with that philosophy. Just coincidentally, no doubt, that this philosophy seems to be paid for by large corporate interests or the very wealthy. So if you're a multimillionaire, you really don't worry terribly much about how you're going to feed your family. You don't worry how you're going to educate your family, how you're going to provide housing for your family. You got it. You got it. You don't worry about the people who don't have it. And obviously, as we've talked about many times on this program, what the media doesn't see, but ordinary Americans do see, is that the middle class is shrinking. People are working longer hours for low wages. We're losing good-paying manufacturing and information technology jobs. We're replacing those jobs with low-paying service industry, Walmart-type jobs. We're looking at a nation where our healthcare system is literally disintegrating. More and more people have no health insurance. More and more people are paying high premiums, high deductibles, high co-payments. People can't afford to see a doctor. College education, as we talked about a moment ago, is increasingly expensive. More low-income kids now than previously are not being able to go to college. And meanwhile, in the midst of all of that, the wealthiest people in this country have never had it so good. Last year, CEOs earned a 54% increase in their compensation, while working people could not keep up with inflation. So what you're seeing in America is really the people on top doing just phenomenally well, owning more and more of the wealth of this country, earning more and more of the income of this country, and just almost everybody else struggling hard to keep their heads above water.
Bernie, one of the things that you mentioned that they want to cut is Medicaid. I think a lot of people who have not interacted with the system are unaware of the subtle difference between Medicaid and Medicare. Medicaid is the program to the states, and an awful lot of folks in nursing homes, end-of-life care, a lot of folks who hospice care, things like this, are paid for by Medicaid.
That's a federal state program, also including prescription drugs.
So what's going to happen to somebody who's 70 years old and they're out on the street?
Well, we're beginning to see in some of these states run by right-wing governors, Republican governors, Mississippi comes to mind, other states, what they're doing is just cutting the plug. I mean, we are approaching that stage now where I think some of these right-wingers are going to say, sorry, there is no funds available for your medicine.
This is like euthanasia by neglect.
That's exactly right. You know,
they're against Oregon's death with dignity law,
this is rationing by dollars. In other words, it's not government edict. It's just that will be no program. You don't have any money. You don't get anything. And guess what? You get sick or you die. Yes, that is where we are moving. And again, in the midst of all this, our people pay by far the highest prices for prescription drugs of any country in the world. We are the only industrialized nation that does not, in one form or another, regulate the pharmaceutical industry, which essentially owns the Bush administration and the Congress today, unfortunately.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical industry and the oil industry.
Yeah.
We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment in the Times. They are a change. And I'm telling you, Americans are waking up to what's going on with this administration. There are now, Bernie, the opinion poll this morning, 19% approval rating for Dick Cheney. That's fewer than the number of Americans who will tell pollsters that they believe that aliens are in contact with the U.S. government. So I think people are really waking up to what's going on. Let's take some phone calls here. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. And Ken in Philadelphia, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bern.
Hi, Ken.
I didn't understand how bad the middle class, how much trouble we're in until I heard the comments from Alan Greenspan yesterday when they had asked him, How can you justify the economy being okay when all the jobs that are being lost and the way no wage increases? And he had said that the upper class is fine, essentially. He said the reason that the middle class and the lower class aren't hiring is because the kids coming out of schools aren't smart enough, essentially.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that he said that.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, Ken. When I have had the opportunity as a member of the Financial Services Committee to ask direct questions to Alan Greenspan, and when you do confront them with direct questions, it is just amazing how weak and ineffective their answers are. We hear over and over again about how good the economy is doing until we begin to talk about what's happening to average people. And as you know, all over America, people are seeing a decline in their standard of living because their wages are not keeping up with inflation. They're losing health care. They're losing their pensions and so forth and so on. What these guys, what Greenspan and others try to do is look at things like GNP and broad statistics would say the economy is growing, but they forget to tell us who is benefiting and who is not benefiting. When you're dealing with a guy like Greenspan, you're dealing with an extreme right-wing guy. This is a fella, upon a question asking, being asked a question by me, does not believe in the concept of the minimum wage, believes in unfettered free trade, despite the fact that we have lost millions of decent paying jobs. And then what they say, well, the problem is not public policy, not a tax policy which gives tax breaks to the rich. Oh, those are fine things. It's just that our kids are not smart enough to get decent jobs. Meanwhile, they will cut back on funding for education. So I'm glad you picked up on that point, because when questioned, Greenspan's ideology is absolutely bankrupt in terms of how it addresses the needs of ordinary Americans.
And it's not inconsistent with the ideology of the Republican Party, this administration, and some Democrats, for that matter.
Absolutely. Now, Greenspan has been an absolute proponent from day one of unfettered free trade, tax breaks for the wealthiest people, and cutting back on privatizing Social Security, cutting back on Medicare, cutting back on Medicaid. This guy is an extreme right-winger who wants to get the government out of efforts to help the middle class.
Tree in Montpelier, Vermont. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Bernie?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, he doesn't hear me. Would you please vote for Xanax, Risperdal, and Seroquel? Because I take Xanax, I've been on it for 25 years, I had visual migraines, and the neurologist put me on it, and I can see now, but without it, I can't see. And I'm on it right now, but the Medicare D took it off the list.
All right, Trina, what I would suggest you do, give our office in Burlington
I did, honey.
Okay.
I wrote that letter out, and I sent it to you, and I wanted to call you to get be able
okay.
to. Please
okay.
vote for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
okay.
dear.
We'll do it. And don't hesitate to actually call Bernie's office as well, Tree. Brian in Louisville, Kentucky. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our number 1-866-440-8466. Hey, Brian. Or
hey,
Blaine.
Blaine.
I'm sorry. Blaine. There you go.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Bernie. You were touching base on things like the high energy costs for heating fuel and gasoline, et cetera. I heard in the news, it's been several weeks, and I don't understand the difference between a resolution and a bill, but I heard that Congress had passed a resolution to look into the development of more oil refineries. And my question is, it's my understanding over the course of the last decade, we've mothballed over, you know, dozens of them. Why are we looking into building new when we have other ones just need to be fired up?
Well, I think your point, well, the difference between a resolution is a resolution doesn't have any teeth behind it. Just in a sense of Congress is what we would like to do. And your point is well taken. One of the problems, as I understand it, is that a number of refineries in this country have actually been closed down. There is at least some evidence to suggest that the oil companies like that idea, because if production goes down, then their profits go up.
This is what they did in California. This is what Enron did in California.
Right.
With the energy crisis.
Right. So I think what Congress has got to really look at is why refineries were shut down, which is causing a huge impact on our capabilities to produce more oil and get it into the market. That's the issue that we've got to look at.
So, and that was, there was a resolution to that effect. There was not any kind of legislation about this.
Right. And once again, understanding, and a lot of people don't understand this, with Republicans controlling the House and the Senate and every single committee and being beholden to the big oil companies, it remains to be seen how much pressure they are really going to be placing on these guys to do the right thing.
Yeah, they do. They speak the right words, but the right actions very often missing.
Campaign contributions often trump words.
There you go. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, Bernie.org. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders as we do the first hour of every program, every Friday morning or Friday afternoon, wherever you may be in the country or the world. And Bernie Sanders, one of the most effective members of Congress for his state of Vermont in the entire United States Congress. And in my opinion, one of the most honorable and just good guys in politics. I just, you know, I'm not sucking up.
Now,
to
you're
you,
making
Bernie.
Me blush here.
I'm sorry, but I just, I you know, thank every you now and then, I very rarely share my opinion of you with you, and I just have to say I have tremendous respect for you, and I, you know, anybody who's willing to put up with what you put up with and just keep fighting the fight every single day, day after day after day, on behalf of his state and his constituents and the people of the United States, but I know, you know, Vermont first, and it is, you know. Anyhow, Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, I would echo everything Tom said about you, Bernie. I wouldn't repeat it. I'll make you blush.
Thank you very much.
I think you're one of the best, probably the best congressman.
Thank you very much.
I love Bernie Day. Anyway, I was listening to the conversation in the early part of the hour here about the Republicans, and they want to cut, and of course all they want to do is cut taxes for the rich. They want to cut food stamps. They want to cut home heating for poor people. But that's what they're all about, you know. And what bothers me is the constituents out there, the folks, even the middle class and the poor who will vote for these guys.
Yes.
And myself, I have to admit, just for full disclosure here, than on things like prayer and public schools and Ten Commandments displays, and I'm even pro-life. Even though I feel that way, I would still vote for progressive Democrats who feel differently. However, I'm in the minority, and I think Hillary Clinton said it maybe about a year ago. She says maybe the Democrats have to start I'm just paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
Basically, her thought was maybe we have to, you know, get a little more moderate, at least on issues like abortion, because I don't think you're going to get to these people unless they're absolutely starving and homeless. They are going to concentrate on things like abortion and prayer and gun control and all that stuff. What do you think? Was Hillary right?
Well, thanks for asking that question, because it's an important question. And let me start off by saying that, you know, sometimes we forget, but everybody has disagreements with everybody, right? I disagree with my wife on many issues. Very few things that people will be 100% agreed upon. The question is, how do we approach politics? Do we use one issue out there that says, well, gee, I'm with somebody 90% of the time, but I'm going to vote against them because of this one issue? I think what we have to do is prioritize. Now, in my own state, I should say I am 100% pro-choice. That's my view. That's what I believe. I believe the government should not be making those decisions for women. I have friends, supporters who disagree with me on that, and we respect each other. We don't have to hate each other because we disagree on that issue or on other issues. I think what we need to say is, okay, how do we work together on those issues that we can agree upon, understanding that there will be other issues out there that we disagree upon? For example, should every person in this country have health care as a right of citizenship? Should we continue to see our jobs go to China and our kids working at low-wage jobs? Should we be giving more tax breaks to the rich or adequately funding education? On those issues, huge numbers of people come together and they agree as to where we should go as a nation. Now, what the Republicans do, who are on the other side of that issue, who are in the small minority, they say, gee, we can't win that debate. We've got to deflect attention to other issues. So let's talk about gay marriage. Let's talk about abortion. Let's talk about guns and so forth and so on. And I think the caller is absolutely right. A lot of people respond to that. So my answer is, there are issues. Let's be honest about it. We are going to disagree. I am pro-choice. You are pro-life. Let's respect each other. Let's say we disagree on that. But let's come together on those issues where we do agree to make sure that our kids do not have a lower standard of living than we do, to make sure that our environment does not make, that the destruction of our environment doesn't make our kids sick, that we don't go to unnecessary wars. So let's agree to disagree on certain issues, but let's not get torn apart by these right-wing Republicans who clearly represent a handful of very wealthy individuals and large corporations and are working hard against the vast majority of the American people. Does that make sense to you?
Rick is gone now, but I suspect it does. That was Rick in Grand Rapids.
Yeah.
We'll move along. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. Dennis, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen. It's a great pleasure, as always, to talk to you, Congressman. I'll wait a month this time before I call you back. But my issue is, and what I'm concerned about is, I think it's too late, too little too late. I think it's great that the country's finally waking up. But, you know, since they already control the House, they control the Senate, they control the courts now, Alito, there's no way that we can stop him from being appointed. So, you know, it's kind of like playing football where somebody's changed the rules on you. They own the referees, and they know where all the holes are in the field. And, you know, we're at a disadvantage. The only way we can do it is to change the playing venue and start it all over again. I'm not sure what we can do to change the rules now. I think they are so entrenched. It's going to be impossible for us to...
Well, Dennis, I'm not sure that I agree with you. I mean, I think as Tom started off this program by telling us that the president's job performance numbers are way, way down. The vice president is probably as low as almost any public official that I can remember. I think we have a good chance if we organize, if we work very hard, if we focus on the issues that really make sense to the middle class in this country, we have the opportunity to take back the House. We have the opportunity to take back the Senate. And when we do that, by the way, we can start asking the President of the United States some questions that the Republican leadership has never, ever asked them about Iraq, about the economy, and many other issues. we can make some very, very fundamental changes. So I'm not as pessimistic as you are, Dennis. I think the momentum is with us. I think we've got to work very, very hard. I think we have a chance to take back both the House and the Senate.
And by the way, for those folks concerned about Alito, there's a website, nocrony.com, that's worth checking out. It gives you an opportunity to immediately respond to your members of Congress. John in Seattle, Washington on the line. John, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Tom. Hello,
hey,
Congressman.
Hi, John.
The thing I want to bring up is that 50% of the people are really upset at Bush and what's happening. But yet I hear nobody talking about what the Democrats have not done. I mean, after all, it takes two parties to run the Congress because of the lack of decent candidates, a message, or even know how to talk to the American people, they're as much responsible or more than the Republicans. Nobody talks about this.
Well, let's talk about it. John, I am an independent, not a Democrat, although I am working closely with the Democrats. I helped found the Progressive Caucus here in the House, which now has 53 Democrats and me, and look forward to working with the Democrats if I'm elected to the United States Senate. But your point has validity. It is one thing to beat up on Republicans for being in the pocket of big money, for destroying our environment, for attacking our civil liberties, for allowing our health care system to disintegrate. That's fair enough. But what John is saying, what is the alternative? And he's right. So let me, I can't speak for Democrats, but I think that is a valid criticism. And I think the first and foremost thing that the Democratic Party and leadership have got to do is to make it clear that in the struggle for the survival of the middle class that is now taking place, they are forthrightly on the side of working people and the middle class and are prepared to stand up to corporate America and the big money interests, which now have so much power over the political life of this country, our economic life, and our media. And once you make that declaration very clear, a lot of things will follow. But I would agree with John that in many respects, the Democrats have been very ambiguous in terms of the trade issue. Many Democrats have supported terrible trade agreements, which have lost us very decent paying jobs. Democrats have not been strong enough about the need for a national health care program. And so forth and so on. So John's, I think, criticism has validity, and I would hope that the Democratic leadership makes it clear which side they are on.
Donna in Shiner, Texas, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org is Bernie's website, by the way. Donna?
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi, Congressman Sanders.
Hi.
I was wondering if either one of you had heard about Walmart doing away with their health care and benefits program. I heard that early this morning on CNN News, and the reporter was also telling the anchor that it could be a trend in this country. And if Walmart starts the trend, then it could also happen with CNN and others. I'll let you go. I was just wondering if y'all had heard that and if you could find out about it.
No, I have not heard that. That is not my understanding. Walmart is now under a lot of attack. A good friend of mine, Robert Greenwald, in fact, is just doing a DVD talking about the horrendous impact that Walmart is having on our economy in terms of job loss, suburban sprawl, paying workers inadequate wages, providing inadequate benefits. But the issue here is where Walmart does set the trend, because they are by far the largest private sector employer in America, if Walmart is not providing good health benefits, other companies are saying, hey, we're competing with Walmart. Why should we? How can we afford to do that? So what you're seeing in the private sector is that the number of workers who now have insurance from their employers are declining. So Walmart is, in many sense, a trendsetter in many ways. And clearly, the way they treat workers in terms of their ability to organize unions, the wages and benefits they get, is a national disgrace.
And the New York Times reported back on October 26th, Bernie, Walmart memo suggests ways to cut employee benefit costs. Maybe that's what she was thinking of. An internal memo sent to Walmart's board proposes numerous ways to cut down spending on health care and other benefits while seeking to minimize damage to the retailer's reputation. Among recommendations, hiring more part-time workers and discouraging unhealthy people from working at Walmart.
One of the points here that people have been making is that Walmart employees and their kids do not have health insurance. It is the taxpayers of America who pick up the bill when these folks go on to Medicaid.
Yeah, well said. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. This is our regular Friday Brunch with Bernie segment, 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Our phone number, 866-440-8466.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman Radio Program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a voice in the political process. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the founder of the Progressive Caucus, in fact, in the House of Representatives. And Bernie, let's go back to the phone lines here. We have, Whit in Scottsdale, Arizona. Whit, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
May I ask you about the most pressing issue of the day? Do you believe that George Bush allowed the United States military into war in Iraq?
Well, but that is a very good question. And what I believe is, for a start, we need to do what Congress has not yet done. And we just had a vote on this yesterday on the floor of the House. We need a real investigation to answer that question. It is not good enough for the president to say that he got bad intelligence. Maybe that's the case. I suspect that is probably not the case. I think maybe the president and vice president got the intelligence that they wanted by putting a great deal of pressure on our intelligence agencies to give them justifications for going to war. We know that much of what the president and vice president said in leading up to the war is false, is not true. So the question is, did they just get bad information or were they lying? I think we need an investigation to find that out. But by the way, this business with Libby, is much more than just the outrageous act of leaking the name of an intelligence officer, which is obviously a reprehensible act unto itself in terms of national security. What that whole investigation from Fitzgerald is going to lead to, I think, is to answer the question that Witt is asking. Why was it so imperative for the office of the vice president to be attacking a rather low-level bureaucrat like Joe Wilson, who had the temerity to say, excuse me, in Niger, Iraq was not getting plutonium and the material for nuclear weapons. Why did they go after him so much? What were they so afraid of? So I think Witt does ask the $64 question, and we need to find the answer to that, because if this president lied us into Iraq, and many people, including myself, think that there is a real possibility that he did that, that is absolutely reprehensible.
Janet in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Bernie, I just wanted to know what is going on in Congress to help change the Help America Vote Act, because it seems to be working against us, especially in terms of the voting machines. We're not going to win if they don't do something with them.
Well, there is a lot of discussion and a lot of effort to make sure that the American people have full confidence that when they cast their ballot, that ballot is accurately counted. Rush Holt of New Jersey has introduced legislation, which I strongly support, which would create a paper trail so that when you vote, there will be paper that the officials can have to make sure that if there is a recount, need for a recount, we know the actual votes that people cast. This is a very important issue. A number of states are looking at it, and certainly some of us in Congress are as well.
James in Jacksonville, Florida. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Hello, Bernie, and hello, Tom.
Hey, James.
Bernie, I have a question for you. I'm a former Republican, and as a voter, I listen to you every chance I can get on Friday. And I think that you bring two things to the table that, quite frankly, former President Clinton brought to us, and that is that you articulate the issues to the average American extremely well, and secondly, you are likable, which is, as we know it, very necessary for to get elected. Have you ever thought of running as for president under the Democratic Party? Because as we know, we under the two-party system, you have to keep one of those two parties.
James, thank you very much for those compliments. No, I haven't. I'm going to be running for the United States Senate from the state of Vermont. And if we can make it there, that will be a huge step forward and an opportunity not only to better represent my state, but working people throughout this country. But thanks for asking.
And if you want information on Bernie's campaign, go to Bernie.org for that. Dick in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Bernie, you know, and Tom, how can Democrats get elected to office by attacking the corporate interests and profiteers when these corporate interests own and control the mainstream media that largely determine who gets elected, and also they control most of the campaign money? I mean, right now, most Democrats help fund the Republican Party every day, you know, by patronizing grocery stores, hardware stores, and gasoline companies that give most of their funds, if not all of their campaign funding, to the Republican Party. So,
one of the big questions of the day, Bernie.
Yeah, and we have talked about it, and Dick, you're absolutely right. And I think what Tom and I chat about every so often is for the American people to understand that corporate control over the media is as much a political issue as healthcare, the environment, or the war in Iraq. And people have got to raise the issue that you're talking about, Dick. Go to your local radio station and say, excuse me, we want alternative points of view to be heard. We want the Tom Hartman Show. We want Al Franken. We want not just Rush Limbaugh. Go to your local newspaper and say, excuse me, we want to see progressive columnists, not just right-wing columnists. Understand that presentation of information is as political as anything else, and people have to be mobilized in trying to fight for a media which reflects all points of view and not just the interest of big money who controls the media. Furthermore, there are huge opportunities now on the Internet where we are making some progress, and where talk radio now, people like Tom Hartman and others are doing what was not the case 10 years ago. If you turn on talk radio now, you know what? You can hear different points of view that did not used to be the case, but we've got a long way to go, especially on television.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting, Bernie. Yesterday I was watching one of the MSNBC shows. I'm not going to name it. And Katrina VandeHeuvel basically said to the host, you're not dealing with the issues that Americans care about. And he basically cut her off and said, you know, I'm dealing with inside politics here. It was incredible.
Yeah.
And so lean on them as well. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. Thanks so much for being with us, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Much appreciated. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison and John Jay and George Washington and others. Not some right-wing think tank. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, what should the big oil companies be doing with all their profits? Should they just be paying them out to their stockholders? Should they be using it to explore for more oil? Should they be using it to help the public good? Should we have no say in it whatsoever? Should it just be, hey, you know, whatever they damn well please? Yaron Brook is with us. He's the president of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And Yaron, I have a feeling you have a specific take on this.
Absolutely. They should, as you said, they should be able to do whatever they want with it.
Whatever they damn well please.
Absolutely.
And not even pay taxes on it.
Well, ideally, I think that would be true. Of course, they have to pay taxes on it because we have corporate taxes, so they're going to. But
you think we should not tax corporate income?
Absolutely. Corporate income is just another way of taxing us as consumers. It's a hidden way of doing it. It's a way where we can pretend that we're taxing the big old nasty corporations, but they pass that tax on right back to the consumers. Every dime that is paid as corporate taxes is paid by me and you in the cost of the products we buy.
But every dime that I pay in taxes on my paycheck is money that I can't use to buy products from corporations. Therefore, it's a tax to the corporation. If you want to use that kind of logic, I mean, it goes around in circles, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see, you know, almost all taxes eliminated. You know, we could take this to the extreme and cut back government to the point where government does very few things, and therefore most of us don't have to pay taxes.
And if we cut back government, if we got rid of public education, if we got rid of public services, meat inspectors, water inspectors, air inspectors, public health safety, and, you know, got rid of people enforcing minimum wage laws. We did all the things that, well, actually, Congress is kind of moving down that road right now with this budget reconciliation bill. I mean, they're cutting.
Oh, no. That's ridiculous.
I only said they're moving down that road, Your Honor.
They're not even inching towards that road.
Well, they're cutting back on Medicaid. They're cutting back on student loans.
They're cutting back on the growth of Medicaid. They're cutting back on the growth of welfare. I mean, indeed, social spending is higher now than it's ever been in American history.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's nowhere near as much of a cut as you would like. But if they were to do away with all those things in the ultimate libertarian, conservative, objectivist world, if they were to do all of those things, there would still be a need for some kind of government in your view, because somebody's going to have to enforce contract law so that businesses can do business.
Absolutely.
Somebody's going to have to maintain a currency so there's a medium of exchange. Somebody's going to have to protect our borders and protect us from predators and put out fires if our houses catch on fire. And that's pretty much it in your mind, right?
Yeah, I mean, even I don't see any reason the government has to maintain a currency, because as we've talked about, I think in the past, banks did that very, very well pre the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913.
Well, and in fact, the Fed is actually mostly a private corporation. It's owned by the participating banks, and you can buy stock in those banks.
It's given a monopoly power by the government, and I object to it.
Yeah, okay. But so if we went to this utopian world that you're working for, there is still some expense for government.
Sure.
How should that be paid for?
Well, I think there are a number of different ways. We're so far away from that world that these are the kind of problems, you know, I hope we have in 50 to 100 years. But there are a number of ways. One is I think that, for example, corporations should pay something and all of us should pay something, so that our contracts are upheld by the courts. It could be a court fee, in order to use the court system. I also think that we would, and I know this sounds ridiculous, but I think it's absolutely true, we would voluntarily, pay a significant amount in order to sustain the police, the military.
So we should tithe to government, you're suggesting. But let me get back to your thing about the courts. If in order to use the courts you have to pay a fee, that would mean that the people who had the most money had the greatest access to the courts. That doesn't trouble you?
No, because I think the fee would be fixed. That is, the fee would be in order for a contract to be adjudicated. I'm not talking about criminal. I'm talking about criminal. Everybody should have access to the courts, obviously. But in terms of civil cases, when there's a contract in place, in order for the courts to recognize that contract, there would have to be a fee built into that contract that is paid to the court. How that exactly would work in some future society, I'm not a science fiction writer, so I'm not in a position to predict. But I can imagine that patents, there would be fees in order for the government to protect patents. You'd have to, when you registered a patent, you'd have to pay something. There are different services that the government could provide that would involve charging some money, and then the rest would be voluntary. And I think that American people, who are the most generous people in the world, even as they are being taxed at ridiculous levels, would be very generous, particularly when it was very much in their self-interest to maintain a police force and a military and fire departments and so on.
Do you know of any experiment in the world where this kind of libertarian scenario or this extreme conservative scenario or whatever objectivist scenario has played out?
Please don't call it an extreme conservative scenario, because the very word conservative means to conserve, to do things exactly the way they've always been done. But
that's certainly not what these guys in Congress are about.
In a sense, it is like what America was in the 19th century. I mean,
during the era of the robber barons.
Well, they weren't
after the
robber
Civil
barons.
War.
They're indeed the industrialists that created the wealth and the prosperity that we have today, and created the middle class, and created the high-paid labor that existed in the
United States. You don't think that the laborers created the wealth that was accumulated by the robber barons?
Absolutely not.
You think it's the other way around? The robber barons created the wealth that the laborers were paid with.
The robber barons created the wealth that was then paid out to laborers, and the robber barons indeed created the jobs that made labor even possible. There was no labor until you had capitalists. Capitalists have to start the process by which the Industrial Revolution creates massive numbers of jobs, which allow people to come in from the
farms. No, no. I mean, you're, let's go back to the beginning.
You're reversing cause and effect by assuming.
No, you are. I have started seven businesses in my life, Your Honor, and every single one of them, I started out basically myself and Louise. We started them out, you know, as small businesses, and one of them grew up to the point where, you know, it had 40 employees and was last year did $24 million in business.
At some point, you became a capitalist. But
no, but
my
point is,
became a capitalist in which you employed people through the
but
capital.
But the only reason that I would ever employ somebody, and the only reason anybody ever employs somebody, is because they believe that they can make more money off that labor than that labor is going to cost them. Labor,
absolutely.
as Abraham Lincoln said, labor is
true. But the only reason labor ever takes a salary is because they believe that they can make more off of that salary than they can off of alternative activities. And if you go back to the 19th century, the alternative activity was subsistence farmers. Going to the factory was a lot more beneficial to the laborer than dying on his farmland somewhere in rural England or in rural America.
Well,
the
Industrial
Revolution was started by the people who invented the steam engine and by invented machinery and then built factories around that and brought in labor from the farmland. You had the largest migration in human history from the farms into the cities in order to take up jobs created by capitalists.
See, I'm sorry, I just don't, capitalists don't create jobs. Capitalists hire people in order to use their labor to make more money.
They hire people. That is the creation of a job. The job wasn't there. Now I've come up with an idea of how to employ somebody, and I employ them. That is the creation of a job.
Yeah, but the
job wasn't there before I, the capitalist, brought in the funds,
but built the
equipment, built the
factory. No, but the point that you're missing here is that if that employee is not doing the job, the capitalist is not making any money. You're saying that the robber barons made all this money, and I'm saying no, their laborers made all this money. They simply accumulated it.
Labor doesn't exist without the capitalist. The capitalist is...
No, capitalists can't exist without labor.
That's absolutely not true. And the fact is that labor is interchangeable and capitalists are not. Capitalists are rare. People who start companies are rare. Managers and CEOs, people who can handle that kind of thing are rare. As we've seen with globalization, labor is common. It's easy to get labor. There are billions...
And the
a billion people who could take a job as a laborer.
There's 5 billion, 6 billion
of them. Who can run a multi-billion-dollar corporation?
And that world set, that mindset that you're articulating there, is the reason why all our jobs are being outsourced. Why we're not protecting our jobs?
Well, but I think it's wonderful that our jobs are being outsourced. It makes it possible for all Americans to benefit from cheaper products, and raises our standard of living uniformly.
Except it drops our wages.
Well, it drops some people's wages, but, you know, if they're not competitive, then it drops. If somebody could do my job better than I can and they're willing to do it at a lower price, that's their right, and they should actually be able to do that. There's nothing to say that Americans should be better off than Indonesians. If Indonesians can do the job better than Americans, they should.
But what if Americans decide that we want to have a certain standard of living in this country, and so we're going to protect our trade across our borders?
I think that involves violating my right to employ an Indonesian to make my shirts, and it's a violation of my property rights.
Okay, Yaron Brook, the president of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Thanks so much for being on with us, Yaron.
My pleasure.
It's always good talking with you.
Right.
It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown?
Why me, George?
Tell me, George, what did I ever do for a whiz kid like you to bring chaos to my home? Lord, help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. That's Jim Turr, by the way, BlueCanyonProductions.com. Welcome back to our program, brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. Their website, 1-800-511-MACS, M-A-C-S, 1-800-511-MACS. If you'd like to call them about anything Macintosh or anything computer, for that matter. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Greg, what's going on in the belly of the beast there in Washington, D.C.?
First of all, let me just say, you always have the best music.
Thank you. Greg, I can't understand what you're... I can hardly understand you. It sounds... Are you on a cell phone or a speakerphone?
I'm not. Is that any better?
No. It's really grim. Greg, I'm going to, why don't you just try calling back and we'll see if we can get a better connection, okay? Okay. I'm going to drop it. I'm sorry. It's wow. We've got to get a decent phone line here. It must be Alberto Gonzalez, right? This is what happens. Every time, you know, somebody's going to come on, they're going to say something really juicy, and Alberto Gonzalez gets a hold of our phone lines, and this is what, well, you know. Anyhow, big oil, record-breaking profits, Congress demagoguing about this. We'll see where it goes. Looks like Greg is back on the line, and as soon as Dan releases him, I will pick it up. Oh, it's still too echoey. Okay, all righty. Greg's got to get a different phone. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. Let's go to Xavier in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Xavier, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Our number, by the way, 1-866-440-THOM. Hey, Xavier.
Yeah, I'm having a problem with a connection on your end, too, so it's really crackly here.
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, well, I'm just going to go ahead and shoot then. I wanted to talk about, back in the day, they had Pinkerton's private security corporations hired their own police force. And what I'm thinking, if we go into this brave new world that your guest is suggesting, workers could also have a security force. And it could turn into a real ugly situation. What I wanted to ask your guest is, if what's the difference between, say, a worker-owned corporation where workers took over a corporation? I would think that workers could manage a corporation better than CEOs could get off their butts and get out there and be workers.
Well, you're on Sutted. I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I'm not sure if I can accurately speak for him, but I've spoken with him enough, and I've you know, Red Eye and Rand stuff.
On the air, Tom.
Say that again?
I'm going to listen on the air.
Okay.
Thanks.
All righty. I'll drop the call. What my guess would be that what Yaron would say was what he just said a few minutes ago, which is there's not a lot of capitalists out there, and there's a lot of people who are willing to engage in labor, and therefore, I doubt he could imagine that kind of a world, the kind of world that, for example, Hugo Chavez is doing in Venezuela, where they're taking factories that have gone vacant for lack of interest on the part of capitalists and saying, yeah, we'll turn these into state-run enterprises. Or what Franklin Roosevelt did, Greg will be calling back in the next hour, by the way, what Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s and said, you know, the government will become the employer of last resort when we got really, really bad times. Robert in Redmond, Washington on the line. Hey, Robert.
Yes, sir.
You're live and on the air. What's up?
That guy that was on there that said we should go back to the 19th century.
Yes, sir.
Because of the capitalists.
Yeah.
I don't think that guy realizes that when Teddy Roosevelt became president in 1901, 80% of the workforce in this country was self-employed.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that statistic. What I did know was that at the turn of the century, the average salary was a little more than was between $8,000 and $9,000 in current U.S. dollars. I don't remember whether it was the exact. It was like $8,650 or something like that. So you know, basically, most Americans were living at what would be today considered a poverty level. There were
but they were making good money.
Some of them, some were, but you know, you had people who owned their own farms who were doing just fine, and then you had the people living in the cities who were, many of them living a pretty desperate existence at the turn of the century. I mean, Leo DiCaprio made a movie about that, in fact. So, but that's interesting. 80% self-employed. That must have been the farms. I didn't know that. Thanks a lot for sharing.
That was one figure that they, when I was going to college 30 years ago or so, that was one of the figures that they kept throwing at us, was that in 1900, That was about a 38 to 40 million person workforce, and 80% of them were self-employed.
Yeah, which would probably mean that they were working in agriculture. I know we've gone from a situation here in the United States where agriculture was a prime mover of the economy, and most people were growing their own food, certainly at the founding of this country, to where now it's, you know, it's a fraction of 1%, I believe, who are, you know, fully employed in agriculture, in direct direct production of food, not including transportation and all those kind of things. Which puts us in a kind of a dicey situation. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the True People's Radio. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Just an old truth teller. Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where being progressive never felt so good. Boy, I'm starting to wonder now what Greg Gorman from the Talk Radio News Service was going to share with us. It was so important that Gonzalez had to get on there and scramble the phone lines. We're going to have to wait until the next hour to find out, David. It's going to be tough. I don't know. Anyhow, I guess right now we should just do a conservative alert. Yes, indeed, my friends. Sam Alito's colleagues, how do they refer to him? His actual colleagues, the actual people who work with him. What do they have to say with him? What do they have to say about him? Well, let's see. In 1993, in the Grant versus Shalala case, Judge Leon Higginbotham said, of what Alito proposes, he said, what Judge Alito proposes to do in his holding is effectively have courts take a backseat to bureaucratic agencies in protecting constitutional liberties. This is a radical and unwise redefinition of the relationship between federal courts and federal agencies. Yeah, that's one of his, another one of his colleagues, Judge Marjorie Rendell, in the Dia versus Ashcroft case in 2003. She said, we suggest that to read, as Judge Alito does, that no reasonable adjudicator standard in a way that does away with the need for substantial evidence not only guts the statutory standard, but ignores our precedent. So, in other words, he's a judicial activist. Judge Richard Nygaard, in the case of Bolden versus Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, 1991, this sweeping assertion divests all public sector employees of their Fourth Amendment rights and strains to make legitimate that which clearly is not. Whoa. What was the sentence that preceded that? Well, let's see. I disagree with Judge Alito's holding that a union has actual authority to waive its members' Fourth Amendment rights bound only by their fair representation doctrine. Amazing. Here we go. Here's Judge Theodore McKee. He said, this in the case of Bryan versus Marriott Hotels, 1997. This, of course, the case where, racial discrimination be acceptable. Judge Alito's position would immunize an employer from the reach of Title VII, which, of course, bans racial discrimination in employment, if the employer's belief that it had selected the best candidate was the result of conscious racial bias. Title VII would be eviscerated. That says in disemboweled, cut their guts out, if our analysis were to halt where Judge Alito's dissent suggests. Another one of his colleagues, Judge Dolores Sloviter. Judge Alito gives no reason why a plaintiff alleging discrimination is not entitled to the real reason for the personnel decision, no matter how uncomfortable the truth may be. Surely the judicial system has little to gain by Judge Alito's approach. And on it goes. In Wiggins versus Smith, he rejects the defendant's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. NoCrony.com. If you want to send a message to Congress about this, check out NoCrony.com or call your member of Congress at 202-225-3121 or toll-free 888-855-3588. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, and Mohammed in Elk Grove, California on the line. Hey, Mohammed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was furious, and I couldn't believe myself when I saw Condoleezza Rice a few days ago, and after the passage
of the UN resolution by this Security Council, demanding that Syria cooperate with the MELIS investigator for the UN. That's fine. The trouble is when she stood up and was pointing to the Syrian official demanding that Syria arrests those officials who did not cooperate and misled Mr. MELIS investigative team. Well, and misled him. Now, look who's talking.
Yeah, for sure.
The woman who misled the whole world and talked about the mushroom cloud that
yep.
he was trying to prevent. She yep. and her the guy before her, Colin Powell, also on February 5th, when he misled the whole world, these American U.S. officials lied and misled their own nation. Who's going to tie them? Who's going to arrest them?
Mohammed, you make a really good point, and I think it's important for us to discuss probably the larger issue here and tell me your take on this. My take on this is that Syria, number one, is not a democracy. It is
right.
essentially a police state. It
right.
is being run like a large corporation, primarily for the benefit of a small number of very wealthy families. In particular, Bashir's family, or what's the main family there that's running the country?
Assad.
And thank you. And that we all need to acknowledge that, and that if they've had a role in assassinating an official in Lebanon, that's a legitimate thing that they and the international community should be investigating.
That's fine.
We're in agreement on that. However, Condi Rice then standing up and saying that doesn't go far enough. We need to arrest Syrian officials who are lying about the investigation. Yeah, I agree with you. It's over the top. It's over the top. It redefines hypocrisy. Mohammed, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Wayne in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wish your guest would take questions from callers. You do a great job at debating him, but I think callers might also have some other questions.
Well, I suspect he would be willing to. When I've got somebody on that I'm debating, well, typically with any guest, we don't keep them on more than one segment, more than 8 or 9 minutes.
Yeah, it's hard to just cover these weighty issues in such a short period of time.
It's kind of a limit. But, one of these times we'll keep you on. He's a regular on the program.
What I would have pointed out to him is he seems to be ignoring the whole idea of inherited wealth. He says capitalists are rare individuals. Well, I don't think Paris Hilton is especially rare. I don't think she'd be able to market herself as a corporation had she not been the heir to the Hilton fortune.
Right. Now, in Yaron's world, that's fine, though, because her great-grandfather was a noble capitalist, and so if wealth accumulates in families, that's their business.
So his idea of all this personal freedom is the rich are free to get richer and the poor are free to get poorer, which
that's
is
right.
essentially
and
what happens. And we've seen that with every time there's more deregulation, there's more concentration of wealth. So
that's right. And the reason why, let me just interrupt you for a second, Wayne, and then you can finish your thought. Pardon my interrupting you. But the reason why it's so important, why I personally feel it's so important to have Yaron and other folks from Ayn Rand and any other conservatives who are willing to come on this program, and they're few and far between. I mean, yesterday Dick Morris hung up on me. But I guess I provoked that, and I probably owe him an apology. But in any case, the point is that the reason why we try to get conservatives on this program, and although very few of them are willing to come, or people who are representing the worldview that is being pursued right now by the Republican Party and by many Democrats, like Joe Lieberman, the more conservative of the Democrats, is because at least these guys are willing to honestly say why. I mean, Americans are sitting around scratching their heads going, why is Congress voting on this budget reconciliation bill that's going to cut back on Medicaid, cut back on student loans, cut back on, why are they refusing to increase the minimum wage? What's going on here? There is a philosophy behind it all, and the philosophy behind it all is well articulated by him, and I think it's important that people understand what that is, because they have been hiding it because they can't win an election on it. So anytime anybody talks about these issues, they start going, oh, wait a minute, you want gay marriage, don't you? Try to change the subject as fast as they can.
Well, I'd like to hear Yaron say that what he is for is a society where there's a very small group that own incredible percentage of the wealth of the society, and everyone else is scratching out a living, and hear him say that that's his utopian society that he's heading for.
Well, I'll tell you, he believes, that, or and objectivists in general, and libertarians and conservatives who are pursuing these economic policies believe that if you have a society where you've got a small number of very, very wealthy people, that large number who are eking out a subsistence living will very rapidly become a middle class. Now, in fact, if you look at 7,000 years of human history, it right. ain't never worked that way.
Exactly.
But they believe it. And I think that some of them, I think they genuinely believe it. And that's what, you know, Ronald Reagan genuinely believed this stuff. And that's why he was willing to start taking apart the social contract in America. He came into office, 25% of Americans were unionized, 50% of Americans had the equivalent of a union job, full pension, full medical benefits, you know, good unemployment benefits, the whole bit. And now it's down to, what, 8% of the private workforce because of this 25-year war on organized labor that we've had in this country, because they really believe that if we have this one world, you know, the Thomas Friedman, the olive tree and the Lexus, one of the most, in my opinion, Thomas Friedman, one of the most destructive people in this country, because he's influencing the influencers and promoting this free trade stuff and portraying himself at times as a liberal to boot. And it's just very dangerous stuff.
One more quick question.
Yes, sir.
What is the name of your upcoming book, and can I pre-order it? Or
yeah, the only place you can pre-order
it. I looked for it on Amazon, but I didn't find it.
It's there. It's actually there. It's although it's supposed to be embargoed. It's called Ultimate Sacrifice, and it's by me and Lamar Waldron. And you might try searching on Lamar's name, Lamarwaldron, and it'll be out in 2-3 weeks. So.
Okay, great.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And we'll be coming back to your phone calls in just a second. We've got to go to a break in another 10, 15 seconds here. But I just, this conservative alert of Alito, I want to remind you again, nocrony.com is a website where you can right now immediately and easily contact your member of Congress and say, you know, particularly if it's a Democrat, say, you guys can filibuster this guy. I mean, I think Harry Reid was really shocked. You know, Harry Reid getting flowers, candy. I mean, people just, you know, showering him with love and affection for standing up to the Republicans. And it's not like the hardcore left. There is no left in the United States for all practical purposes. The communists are all gone and dead. It's all the rest of us. It's the radical middle. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough. Yeah, we look in the mirror. Yeah, we wanna give up.
Nah, but don't give up. Don't ever give up. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, there you go. Van Morrison. Somebody told... I'm saying, you know, Van Morrison, his song Moondance, back when I was back in my younger years, when I used to do a progressive rock all night show back in East Lansing, Michigan, many, many years ago. My theme song was Van Morrison's Moondance, and I still love his music. And somebody recently told me that he was a supporter of Bush, and I don't know. I still like his music, but if it's true, I cringe. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM, or 440-8466, the same thing. Geraldine in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Geraldine, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. And number one, thank you for pointing out how bad Reagan is. I wanted you to ask your capitalist where that capital originated.
Well, that was my point to him, was that, I said I've started a series of businesses over the 30 or so years that I've been in business, and I started every one with the sweat of my brow, as it were. And he said, well, then you became a capitalist, because I have had businesses that were large enough that we hired people. And, we were in the middle of an argument, and I didn't want to wander off into my own biography. But the reality is, no, I've never been a capitalist, because a capitalist is a person who invests money and then sits back and takes a return on their investment. And, you know, other than a little bit of stock and retirement money, you know, that the government lets you have, you know, 401k kind of stuff, I have never done that. I have been an entrepreneur. I've been engaged in free enterprise. I've been a small business person. In fact, this radio show is a small business. But I've never been a capitalist. I've never put money out and let other people work, and the return of their sweat has come back to me in the form of capital.
But that's where wealth begins, is with somebody's
with labor.
Sweat.
That's
and
right.
Somebody's producing a product that sells. So how did his capital originate?
Yeah, well, and that's the argument that he and I were having. And I'm saying I agree with Abraham Lincoln when Abraham Lincoln said labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital. There can be no capital without there first being labor. And I'm probably...
And he doesn't believe that. Where does he... Did he think he just walked out in the backyard and picked up his coin of the realm?
Well, you'll have to ask him. You know, we get him on regularly, and the next time he's on, you know, give us a call, and I'll ask him if he wants to take some calls.
Well, you generally don't take calls, but that Reagan thing, he ruined our schools here in California, and every time somebody praises him, I was out banging on doors to keep our schools in good shape when he came into office, and to no avail.
Oh, as governor, yeah. He did tremendous damage to California as governor.
Terrible.
He began the taking apart.
Our system went from... like the best in the nation to like 42nd, just real quick.
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Okay, well, keep that up because these people in awe of Reagan just blow my mind.
I'll do it, Geraldine. Thanks a lot, and thanks for listening on 1240 Talk City there in Sacramento. Alan in Trumansburg, New York. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. We've got local elections coming up here for like town board and stuff like that.
Yes, sir.
I've been writing letters to the editor in support of the Democratic candidates. Because Tom Hartman told me to.
Well, I hope you have a better reason than that.
Well, I mean, you say get active. Join.
Oh, I see.
Get active in your Democratic Party or Green Party or whatever,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I do. I really do. But
yeah.
And we need to do that. Well, yeah.
So,
okay.
So that's what I'm doing. And it was interesting. I got a Republican wrote in a letter attacking my letter by saying that party affiliation doesn't really have anything to do with local small-town politics.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a common tactic lately because the Republicans are embarrassed, understandably, and want to distance themselves from the Bushes and the delays and the Frists and the Evermoths.
Yeah. Well, there's two things going on here, Alan. One is that you're correctly assessing, you know, they're trying to change the subject and all that kind of thing. The second is that at some level, party politics at the local level are not as important because, for example, in the 200 and some odd, almost 300 communities that have adopted instant runoff voting around the United States, it's almost always been done by the Green Party. And so, in fact, I encourage people at the local level to participate with the local Green Party or join it. You know, and you can also participate with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party for that
matter. Right. Okay.
But the most important thing, if I may, just very quickly, the most important thing is that local politics is the incubator for national politics. Pretty much everybody in national politics started out, even if it was dog catcher or school board, started out locally. And in that regard, it's real important, party affiliation at the local level.
Yes. I think party affiliation really does matter, and I'm not as throwing my weight behind the Democratic Party as I am wanting to take a shot at the Republican Party, because it seems to me that, like, if I was a Eisenhower Republican in the last year or two or ten, I would have had to jump ship, because just looking at what's going on, if you have any integrity and intelligence, you can't be a Republican anymore. So why should we elect people that demonstrate that lack of character and then pay their salaries with our tax dollars?
Yeah, as did. I mean, he actually did jump ship. He said, you know, enough of that. I'm not putting up with this anymore. My party has moved out from underneath us, from underneath me, and I can't have anything to do with it any longer.
So a lot of these small local elections don't get much of a turnout, and I think it's because people don't really understand the issues. They're not covered as well in the press as the national issues, and they're hesitant to bother going to the polls because they don't really want to just vote the Democratic line or whatever. But I think it's worth going out even if you don't fully understand the issues and voting against the Republicans, whether it be Democrat, Green, Independent, whatever.
I agree with you, Alan, and I'm going to do it because you said so.
Okay.
You're absolutely spot on right, and thank you so much. I appreciate it, Alan, and thanks for being, you've become an activist, and that's the marvelous transition from becoming a passive watcher of politics, an observer, a person with an opinion. You know, what's the famous saying about opinions? Well, we need not go there. To becoming active, you know, and that's what we need if we're going to rescue this country from the Reich. We need activists. I'm Tom Hartman. Viagra for your brain, our program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
53%! 53% of Americans, this is a brand new Zogby poll just released. Just lost my headphones here. Brand new Zogby poll just released found that 53% of Americans agree with the statement, if President Bush did not tell the reasons about his, did not tell the truth about his reasons for going to war with Iraq, Congress should consider holding him accountable through impeachment. 42% disagreed, 5% said they didn't know or declined to answer. The poll has a plus or minus 2.9% margin of error. 53%. A majority of Americans now saying that they agree that if Bush lied us into war, then he should be impeached. This is a big deal. It's a legitimate big deal. So, and something that should be trumpeted far and wide, in my opinion, as soon as possible. Pretty amazing. If Bush lied, 53%. And see, this is, you know, why is Scooter Libby out there? You know, why are they trying to do character assassination on Joe Wilson? Why is this going on? Because if the American people find out that lies were told and that they were trying to cover up lies, then they're going to nail them. David, I just pulled the wire in these headphones and they're dead. I can no longer hear myself. There's a pair in there on the, in the little black thing. It's just a little pair of earphones that, I need. So, anyhow, forgive the inside radio stuff, but I can't hear callers. That's great. Thank you. Let me just pull a plug on these, and I'm going to switch headphones here, and on we go with the show. Hey, nothing like a spare. Eureka! Now I can hear my callers. So, let's go to the telephones. Jeff in Eureka, California. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi. In the past, you've had guests on from organizations that look into these black box voting machines and know what needs to be fixed to make them accurately record our vote.
Yes, sir.
And I was wondering, I thought it might be a good idea, or maybe they already have these. Do they have any, like, I know they have websites, but on these websites, do they have petitions that you can sign that outline exactly what's wrong and what needs to be done so that, you know, we can mass mail these petitions to all of representatives and senators and such?
Well, yes and no. Here's part of the problem, Jeff, is that there's a whole bunch of different groups and different people who are taking different positions about the different things that need to be done. I mean, there are people who think that if we can just make sure that the machines have some integrity. For example, that there should be some, you know, national standards or national testing or state standards. There's that group. Then one step up from that are people who are saying, well, if you're going to have machines, the machine should print a paper ballot or a paper receipt, rather, so that there's, you know, people have confidence in them. That, I think, is very dangerous, frankly, because people will have confidence and they may be misplaced. Then one step up from that, there are the folks who are saying that the machine should print an actual paper ballot that you can see behind a glass window that drops into a box that actually is your vote, and you can see that the ballot is your vote, and that way there's a ballot that can be counted. And then one step up from that, there are people who are saying it should print a ballot, and then you take that ballot by hand over to another machine and drop it in, and it counts it. So you've got two machines counting your vote. And so there's some redundancy there. You'd have to hack two machines identically at the same time. And then one step up from that, there's folks like me who are saying that private corporations should not be in this business at all. And that, you know, if we're going to have machines, okay, you know, maybe, but the machines should be owned by government and should be programmed in an open source fashion. And until this gets settled out, probably the best that we have right now is Congressman Rush Holt's bill that Bernie Sanders was referring to in our first hour, which calls for a paper ballot trail, and also calls for the paper ballot trail, and also calls for random audits. And I think random audits are really, really important to find out if there's fraud. So, that's where I'm at on that.
Is that Congress Rush Holt you're talking about? Is that going to work if there's people who have hands? If more than one person has their hands on these little, I forget who the guest was. It was a woman from Black Box, somebody.
Yeah, Bev Harris from Black Box.
They have hands on all of these chips, and you know, basically anyone can take this chip, put it out, and pull in. Will that bill that this guy's trying to push, would that work if people have their hands on these chips?
That would solve the problem of they're basically memory cards, and it would solve the problem of that because those memory cards are used in paperless voting systems like they used in Georgia in the year 2002 when all the polls showed that Max Cleland won, but the paperless memory card voting machines showed that Saxby Chambliss won. Yes, it would solve that problem.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think the best that we have right now is Rush Holt's bill, and I think it's worthy of support. And so you just contact your member of Congress, and there's a similar bill in the United States Senate that Hillary Clinton put forward, by the way. Just let them know, hey, you're in favor of this. And in fact, it looks like probably either one of these bills would have a good chance of passing. The problem is the Republican leadership of both the House and the Senate are refusing to let them out of committee.
Right.
So they're not being voted on.
Okay.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Yep, Jeff in Denver, from Jeff to Jeff. Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff.
There are a lot of us.
Hey, there you go.
The Hogbee poll shows that the diehard Bush supporters are dying.
Well, I think what's happening is the diehard Bush supporters are waking up.
Yeah.
You know, America, all across America, people are waking up and going, hey, whoa, wait a minute. You know, what's going on with this? We thought these guys believed in the United States of America. We thought these guys believed in American principles. And what we're discovering is that all they want is war, a police state, no civil liberties, and absolutely no social services. And you know, it might be the old conservative way, it might be the old Republican way, but it's certainly not the traditional American way.
Yeah. Anyway, what I called about was Euron's thing of saying that it's better for people to work on the farms than in factories rather than farms. Well, I was raised in Lowell, Massachusetts, a mill town, and we had the Italian section of town, we had the Irish sections of town, and so forth. We had all these people. The Irish who were suppressed came over because they're desperate, and all they had a choice was to go to work in the mills and so forth. That was basically slave labor. We didn't have the farmer section of town.
It wasn't just basically slave labor. A lot of them came over as indentured servants, where they had, you know, 5, 10, 15, in some cases 20 years to work off an indenture, and they were, during that period of time, slave labor.
Yeah, but we didn't have the farmer. We had no farmer section of town. The farmers weren't coming in from the countryside to work, and the growth of the U.S. was by the farmers and wagon trains going out west. They weren't the capitalists. It was the miners going out and so forth. So it really was the labor that was producing this stuff. And the people in the mills didn't have a choice.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, in the chat room, one of the folks tells me this is H.R. 550, is Rush Holt's bill. 144 signatures, only 3 Republicans. That's tragic.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the problem that is in almost everybody's voting reform thing is it's always checking if the problem is suspected. And you're talking about the random audits. Well, a lot of people are proposing audits that are so small, they're insignificant.
Yeah.
So we've got to check the vote up front. We've got to prevent problems rather than check in case we suspect there's one.
Right, and there's also suggestions that there be a kind of a secondary vote stream, that there be a random exit polls, there's a lot of ways to deal with this. I think the simplest thing to do is to do what every other advanced democracy in the world has done, and that is vote on paper and count it by hand. And if it takes 2 or 3 days, that's fine. We hold our elections in November, and people take office in January. That's plenty of time.
And what we made the mistake of here, like in Colorado, for example, legislation we got passed, and a lot of places, is the paper ballot is not the official record of the election. They still keep the electronic record as the official record.
Yeah, and
we
that's wrong.
The paper, the paper ballot must be the official record of the election.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Good to hear from you.
Take care.
Don, yeah, thank you. You too. Don in Fort Bragg, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking about the electoral votes. I was just looking at the numbers, and it seems like year after year, blue states seem to lose electoral votes while red states gain electoral votes. Am I seeing this right? Is there a reason for this?
Are you talking about shifts in population, or I'm not sure what you're talking about, frankly, Don. I'm sorry.
Well, like California has what, 50 electoral votes, or whatever they have for the presidential election. Then
right, the number of electors being the sum of their members of the House and Senate.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Well, I mean, I was adding it up, and every census or every 4 years, it seems like blue states lose, 5-10 votes, and red states gain, around 7 or whatever.
Well, there has been somewhat of a trend of, people moving toward the South in particular over the last 40, 50 years since the invention of air conditioning. And in part also arguably because of Taft-Hartley, because the southern states decided to opt out of Wagner Act provisions and say, we'll become a no-union state zone kind of thing. But frankly, I think that's all changing, Don. I think the whole notion of red states and blue states is one that's an anachronism. There really is no such thing. There's not any state in the United States where everybody in that state voted for Bush or everybody in that state voted for Kerry. The reality is that we have a whole bunch of purple states, and some are a little, lean a little bit in one way, a little bit in another way, but mostly there's the vast American radical middle. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here at 21 and a half minutes past the hour, if you'd like. The place where you'll find truth and common sense in broadcasting, the Tom Hartman radio program. Time for a caught you doing something right moment. Yes, we like to much rather catch people doing things right than catch doing things wrong. This Frank Lautenberg. Frank R. Lautenberg introduced into the United States Senate yesterday, Amendment 2393. And this would have changed the Deficit Reduction Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 2005. This is the bill that Bernie Sanders is talking about in our first hour of the program, where they reconcile the budget between the House and the Senate, and it's basically an up or down vote. It contains things like drilling for ANWR and cutting back on Medicaid and cutting back on student loans and all these kinds of things, and also includes some $50 to $70 billion in tax cuts for multimillionaires and billionaires. Changing the name of that act from the Deficit Reconciliation Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 2005 to the Moral Disaster of Monumental Proportion Reconciliation Act. Good on you, Frank Lautenberg. Congratulations. Yes, indeed. Frank Lautenberg, our jolly good fellow of the day. Done good. Much appreciated. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Greg Gorman is back with us with the Talk Radio News Service. We are convinced, Greg, that Alberto Gonzalez got a hold of your line and scrambled it because you had something really important to tell us from Washington, D.C. What was it?
Well, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about this new, I'm on a kick about how important legislation can be, and when it's in the wrong hands, how bad it can be. There's some good legislation that's happening on the Hill today. There's a new thing on Planned Parenthood. Representatives Carolyn Maloney and Joseph Crowley, both from New York, Chris Shays of Connecticut, and Jay Inslee of Washington have a bill called Plan B for Plan B Act of 2005. And the reason I think this is interesting is because it's legislation that's going to force the FDA into making a decision on the over-the-counter Plan B emergency contraception pill, which I guess, people on the Hill are sick and tired of the FDA waiting around, and they want them to make a decision. So they have now forced their hand by creating legislation. So if this is what Congress has come to, at least there'll be something for them to go back to their home districts and talk about.
Well, that's great. If we want to mobilize the forces and suggest that people call 1-888-355-3588, toll-free number for Congress, 1-888-355-3588, what piece of legislation should they reference when they talk to their member of the House or Senate?
It's called the Plan B for Plan B Act of 2005.
And it, where was it introduced, in the House or the Senate? Or
in
both?
The House.
In the House.
Exactly.
Okay,
in
so
the
they,
House.
They should call their member of Congress then.
Exactly. Call their member of Congress.
House
and
Representatives.
Ask for the Plan B for, if they just call it the Plan B for Plan B Act, it'll be fine.
Right, okay.
They won't need to know the people. Like I said, it's, you know, this is something that actually people, you know, Tom, that's a great point. This is something that people can do. You can call your congressman or woman and you can tell them, I approve of this. And, you know, maybe they can also do things like, look, I approve of legislation like this that actually gets involved and forces other agencies into action. If they're sick and tired of people just sitting around and letting bills languish in Congress,
yeah.
It's not all about politics. This is actually something that will happen and will force someone's hand.
Well, and the reality, Greg, is it's not quite sitting around and languishing. The Republicans are aggressively blocking progressive legislation or any kind of legislation that does anything other than cut benefits or cut taxes for millionaires and billionaires. They have
right.
a very single-minded agenda, and they have ever since Ronald Reagan came into office. Actually, you could argue that they've had that agenda since the 1870s, which is why the Republicans historically have been a minority party.
Well, you know, Tom, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is very controversial legislation, mainly because of what it's about. Obviously, you know, Plan B emergency contraception is a pill you take the night after. And, of course, this is all about sex, you know, unprotected sex, unwanted pregnancy, sexual assault, HIV. I mean, all these issues are hot button issues. And it's something that the Republicans don't really want to have to talk about. Now, because of these four representatives, the FDA will have to decide.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, I mean, we had this story, I believe it was out of Tucson, Arizona, just a week or so ago, where a woman had been sexually assaulted. She had been raped, and she went to her doctor and got a prescription for Plan B, so that, because it takes 72 hours in the time from intercourse to actual fertilization of the egg. So you've got a three-day window in there where you can prevent conception. This has got nothing to do with abortion. This is birth control. And so she was trying to find a pharmacy that had Plan B. She called all over Tucson. Turns out that only about a third of the pharmacies or half the pharmacies in town even carry it. She finally found a pharmacy that carried it, showed up with her prescription, and the pharmacist said, I will not fill this prescription. It violates my religious precepts as a Catholic who believes that you should not have availability to access to contraception. And the woman's like, but I've been raped. Tough luck.
Oh, I mean, that's exactly the point I was trying to make. This is about freedom of choice in this country. We still have the right to choose what we do with our own bodies, women and men. And if there is someone on the, you know, if there's a pharmacist, if I walk in and want my medication and anyone tells me that I cannot do it, I would feel violated all over again.
Yeah, yeah. And she was. And she felt that way. And this is wrong. And we need to shake this thing up. Great. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Greg, thanks a lot for the call.
Always good.
Great to hear from you. Yep. Always good to have you here. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour, 866-440-THOM. Our telephone number. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Taking care of business here. 34 and a half minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. William in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, William.
Hello, Tom Hartman. I'm a faithful listener to your program, where I know the truth is spoken. I've been wondering whatever has happened to Cindy Sheehan. issue.
Well, you know, I was wondering the exact same thing, and hang on just a second here. Let me put David on the air. David, I a half hour ago or so, David went off on a search to see if he could figure it out.
I couldn't get a hold of her new handler, so I'm not quite sure where we're at with that yet, but we will know shortly.
Okay, great. Thank you, David. David is trying to track it. David Poole here, one of our producers, is trying to track this stuff down. So we're going to find out, because last time I talked to her, she was like, I'm going to go back to the White House over and over and get arrested over and over. And
yeah.
Ellen Ratner was saying, don't do that because they'll lock you up and shut you up. And I haven't heard, word one from or about her in about a week, and it concerns me, frankly. So we will find out, and maybe not in the next 25 minutes. It may be Monday, but I assure you, William, we'll let you know.
Well, I'll be faithfully listening.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bob,
I appreciate it. And don't forget to patronize your sponsors, or our sponsors, the sponsors there on WPTT as well, locally. Gary in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's nice to speak with you.
It's a thank you for listening on KPTK. No, is it KTPK?
Yeah.
AM 1090.
Yeah, I'm actually
Seattle.
Way north of Seattle. I'm on the Canadian border, but
my goodness.
That's where I listen.
Yeah, they got a good signal. What's up?
I heard you talking just a while ago about the voting issue and whatnot, and I heard you say that the only way we're going to fix this is to possibly get private companies out of the voting boxes altogether.
Well, what I was saying is that's what every other country has done. Canada, for example, flirted with voting machines for a while and then sent them back, said no thanks.
Yeah. I think, and I just want to interject this into the mix, into the conversation, because I don't hear it said. The only way this is going to work is for us to stop being dishonest. And I don't know how to fix that exactly, but every time I hear somebody say, well, this law will fix this and this law will fix this, I don't want to be made to act good or act better. I want to be better. And
well, Gary,
I
salute you for your personal initiative in becoming better, but the reality is that there are people in our society who will steal elections if they have an opportunity. And the only way we can prevent them is legislatively.
I understand that, but as long as we don't mention that as one of the things we can grasp for, then we won't grasp for it at all.
Okay.
I just think it needs to be in the conversation.
Yeah. Well, you did a good job of interjecting it, from my side, I would say that's a given. I was assuming that, but I think you did a good job of saying it out loud.
Well, you heard the Walter Cronkite comment last week, 2 weeks ago, whatever. He's quite afraid. He says that the American people are not good enough to make good political decisions right now, and
yeah.
He's quite distressed about it.
Yeah, I didn't hear that, actually, and I need to go back because I've heard about it. I've also heard about Dan Rather recently speaking out, and I didn't get the original on that either, so
no,
this is stuff I need to track down some of this stuff. Anyhow, thanks a lot, Gary.
Okay,
good to hear
it
from you. I appreciate it. You too. Rick in Redmond, California. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I'm actually in Richmond.
Richmond, I'm sorry.
Yeah, anyway, I had a question about the eminent domain case that the Supreme Court ruled on about 6 months ago.
Yeah, the Kelso, Kelo case, yeah.
Well, big corporations like Walmart could move in and take your private property over if they provided jobs, a tax base, what have you.
Right.
And I was wondering, the right wing likes to use that as an example of liberal bias on the court.
Yes.
And I was wondering, are they accurate there? I mean,
no, there's not a single Democratic. Let me start over. There, to the best of my knowledge, there's not a single Democratic member of Congress who supports that Supreme Court decision. There, whatever you want to call a liberal, I don't know of anybody who supports that Supreme Court decision.
Yeah.
It is universally reviled. A caller to this program a week or two ago who had some knowledge of the law, I don't recall if it was an attorney or not, suggested that the reason that the Supreme Court ruled the way they did was because if they had failed to, if they had repudiated the doctrine that states or local, that government had the ability to decide for itself what is the public good, whether it's using private, corporations or not, then we'd have to go all the way back to the 1870s when we started taking land and giving them to the railroads, which were private corporations,
mm-hmm.
and it would create absolute chaos. I mean, it would unimaginable chaos with all these claims that it would be placed on land. I don't know if that's true or not. In fact, David and I, David Poole and I, were talking about that very decision in this very question not more than a half hour ago during the break, and we're trying to track down a constitutional expert who can explain to us the rationale. I've read the decision, and frankly, I have to say, I don't understand it. So, you know,
justices voted? I mean, did it come down that the liberal-leaning people voted for it, or the corporatists voted for it, or the right-wingers voted for it? Do you know how that came down?
Yeah, what I know is that Scalia and Thomas voted against it.
They voted against that decision.
Yeah, they did. And I'm not sure about Rehnquist. I believe it was a 6-3 decision. It might have been a 5-4 decision. But yeah, by and large, it was the arch conservatives on the court voted against it. But you know, when you know that the vote is going to go against you, it's really easy to kind of make that decision and take a principled stand.
Right.
If it looked like there was going to be actually a majority to vote against it, and it would have created that kind of legal chaos, they might have changed their minds. I don't know, frankly, and that's why I'd like to get somebody who really knows the court to explain this to us. But I guarantee you, this has nothing to do with liberal or conservative. This has something to do with the way that law has been conducted and the way that eminent domain has been exercised in the United States for well over 100 years.
Yeah.
And whether or not a new precedent was going to be established or whether or not an old precedent was going to be respected. And my reading of that decision was that they thought that what the majority thought that what they were doing was simply in keeping with established precedent. And then you read the minority decisions, and I believe Sandra Day O'Connor wrote one of the minority decisions where she said, you know, this is a terrible thing. I'd have to go back and read it. It's been what, 6 months or so since that happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the minority decisions are pretty strongly worded, and I have to say I agree with them. So you know, yeah, but the right-wing bloviators on the radio are saying this is what the liberals will bring you. They're wrong. You know, they're wrong, as usual. So,
all
Rick,
right,
thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Okay.
Mike, you're live and on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's been a long time. I've been trying to get a hold of you. It's actually my first time ever calling.
Well, thank
radio
you.
Station, so hopefully I get this out straight. I turned on the car radio, and I heard you talking about voter reform.
Mm-hmm.
And the legislation that's going on, like 115 Democrats and...
Three Republicans. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just amazing that I hope people can read into the numbers that, you know, if a Democrat were to win an election using a black box, a Democrat is voting for saying it's okay to check the records and to check if the validity of the election was right. Whereas only three Republicans say, yeah, you can check the record, and the rest are kind of shying away from it.
Right. Well, and this is, you know, I keep sharing this with folks on this program, and it's probably worth revisiting. Here it is.
Bev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
Just listen to this for a minute,
well,
Mike.
What we have here is the central tabulator computer. Now, in a voting system, you have all these different voting machines at all the different polling places. Sometimes, as in a county like mine, there's 1,000 polling places in one county. All those machines feed into the one machine so it can add up all the votes. So, of course, if you were going to do something you shouldn't to a voting machine, would it be more convenient to do it to the 4,000 machines or to just come in here to one machine and deal with all of them at once? What surprises people is the central tabulator is just a PC. It's like you and I use. It uses Windows. It's just a regular computer.
So anybody who can hack into a PC can hack into the central tabulator.
That's
the
Howard Dean there, by the way.
The program is the central tabulator program.
Along with Bev Harris.
I'm going to put in a password here. Okay, we're in. Now, this is the official program that the county supervisor sees.
Is
this the Diebold program? Yes, this is a Diebold central tabulation program.
Okay.
And then go to election summary report. And it's kind of wear and spin for a minute while it adds up all the votes from all the different precincts. And as you can see here, Howard Dean has 1,000 votes. And Lex Luthor has 500, so you're beating Lex Luthor, and we're...
2-1.
Yes, and Tiger Woods, unfortunately, doesn't have any votes yet.
All right,
let's close this out. I was just showing you the way to go in and look at votes, which,
all
of
right.
course, you can't tamper with. Go to the Start menu, and I'm going to show you something tricky. And I want you to go to My Computer and just click that. And you're going to see some... go to Local Disk C. Go to GEMS, which is the name of the Diebold program. You're going to go to LocalDB, which stands for Local Database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the Internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at. And then go to the sum of the candidates, which is that table.
Let's hold back
the break.
You see,
we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400. And we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS the legitimate way. You're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900 and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. Mm. We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds.
We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds. Now, Mike, the message, this, your assignment, sir, should you be willing to accept it, is to tell as many Republicans as you can that the only politician in America who has ever successfully hacked a voting machine on national television, a Diebold machine at that, is Howard Dean, who's the head of the Democratic National Party. Can you do that? Mike?
Yeah, you have nothing to hide. It's amazing how, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the bottom line, and that's, you know, we need to get the word out. We got to take a break right now. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Tom.
But this is the thing, you know, get the word out. Howard Dean, that was Topic A with Tina Brown, the Topic A with Tina Brown program. And it's just, you know, there it is, you know. Democrats know how to hack voting machines. In fact, the head of the Democrats knows how to hack a voting machine. And you would think if enough Republicans in Congress knew that, that they would sign on to Rush Holt's bill, too. You know, unless they know something you and I don't. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, it's a question Jimmy Carter has been asking lately. I want to share a few clips of him asking that very question in just a few moments. It's Friday. We're wrapping up the show here. This is the last segment and the end of the week. And wanted to thank you for being along here with us. And also to thank Louise and David Poole, our producers, for helping put the show together. Shelby and Ben for streaming us on RadioPower.org, CRN Digital, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Alex and Dan at Air America Radio New York for helping engineer the show and answering the phones and keeping everything together on that end. Mike Toth and for our archives, Sue and the folks in our chat room say greetings to you, our affiliates, our advertisers, and especially to you for listening. Thank you very much. It's much appreciated. Our number 1-866-440-8466 and Massey in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Massey, what's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
You are live and on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to tell you that I saw you on that TV show.
The global warming program?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, I thought you were going to have a bigger part, though.
Well, I didn't. You know, you never know until the end. I had a couple of minutes.
Gosh, so. Just seeing you, what you were on and off.
Yeah, my few moments of fame.
Yeah. But anyway, I got to see what you look like anyway.
Yep.
But I wanted to just share this real quick scripture with you, and maybe someone back in D.C. might hear it.
If it's not more than a sentence, Massey, we can't. If it's not more than a sentence, that's okay.
It isn't, but it's a good one for them to keep in mind. I don't know if their clergyman has covered this with them or not, but we're coming down to the last days of this system of things, and pretty soon they're gonna really suffer. But it's in regard to all that money they've been stockpiling.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon this scripture is going to have its fulfillment. It says, into the streets they will throw their very silver, and an abhorrent thing their own gold will become. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them in the day of God's fury.
Yeah, this sounds like Jeremiah.
No, it's Ezekiel.
Ezekiel, okay. It had to be one or the other.
It's the ninth verse.
Yeah.
The seventh chapter and the 19th verse.
Yeah. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, actually some, but
no,
in any case, yeah.
This is Ezekiel, trust me.
Yeah, no, I believe you. I absolutely believe you, and I'm not disagreeing with you, and I appreciate your sharing that with our listeners. And I, by the way, while I'm not convinced that we're living in the last days, I am convinced that the issue of morality, the very real issues of morality that are raised in the Old Testament, in the Jewish Bible, in the New Testament, in the Christian Bible, in the Islamic Bible, in the Quran, in the scriptures of Buddhism, of the Vedic scriptures of Hinduism, are all, you know, they're all saying the same message. The message of Matthew 25 for Christians, the message of Tikkun Lalam out of Judaism that we are born here for the purpose of helping to heal the world. It's our obligation. It's the work we must be doing. And as you do to the least among us, you have done unto, you know, Jesus said unto me. And so Jimmy Carter, the last president who was an outspoken born-again Christian, some outspoken thoughts about things like, for example, torture. Here's Jimmy Carter. He was on the Today Show.
Then the insistence by our government that the CIA or others have the right to torture prisoners in Guantanamo and around the world is just one indication of what this administration has done. That's a radical departure from past policy.
A radical departure from past policy. I mean, here's Jimmy Carter, one of the true statesmen of our time. In fact, frankly, in my opinion, the last really, truly great president that we had. And people say, oh, well, you know, but didn't he wear sweaters in the White House? Yes, he did. If we had followed Jimmy Carter's advice with regard to energy policy, we would not have the problems that we have right now. Here's Jimmy Carter again.
I think tell the American people the truth would be one major start about what happened during to bring the country into war. I think another thing is to abandon the radical policies concerning going to war. We now say we're not going to wait until our country's security is endangered. We're going to have preemptive war. We're going to go to war ahead of time because of our massive military might. The abandonment of basic human rights, the derogation of American civil liberties and personal privacy, the vast rewarding in a time of war of extremely rich Americans at the expense of working class people, the abandonment of protecting the American environment, all of these things are massive and radical departures from what our country has seen under every president in the last 100 or more years in our country. It's not just Republicans versus Democrats. It's this administration versus every administration that has preceded.
Well said, Jimmy Carter. And just incredibly well said. I mean, there's not a better way to say it. So, anyhow, have a great weekend. TGIF, Shabbat Shalom. Enjoy your weekend. Next week, Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief of Frame Shop, is open. He'll join us on Monday. Got some incredible insights into questions that maybe Vice President Dick Cheney should be answering about the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame. Busy weekend. No time for the news. No worries. We will also on Monday have your weekend recap with the best of the rest of the news. So we'll see you again Monday. Same time, same place. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.